Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the way that foreign policy has been made in the Bush administration. That process has been now for some time in the hands of a relatively small number of people. And they are people who have been involved with government and in many ways with each other, going as far back as the presidency of Richard Nixon. Before President Bush was elected, this group of people came together to advise him on foreign policy, and they, partly as a joke, started to refer to themselves as the Vulcans, not the people with the pointy ears on Star Trek. No, they took their name from the ancient Roman god of fire and the forge. When these people took office in 2001, and when President Bush did, they were widely expected to pick up, as far as policy was concerned, where the first Bush administration left off. However, something else happened. They, in fact, took American policy in some dramatically new directions. These are people whose names are familiar. They're in the news almost every day. Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz, and Condoleezza Rice. And these people are the figures that are profiled in a recently published book that we'll be talking about in this first hour of the show. The title of the book is Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, and it's published by Viking and by James Mann. He is at the moment a senior writer in residence in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Before joining that operation, he was diplomatic correspondent and foreign affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He'd worked for the Times for a number of years. He started out there as the Supreme Court correspondent, and then he served between 1984 and 1987 as chief of the Beijing Bureau, and since that time has covered all aspects of U.S.-China relations and also U.S. policy toward Asia. He's the author of two other books, one entitled Beijing Jeep, about foreign firms doing business or trying to do business in China. That was published in 1989. And About Face, A History of America's Curious Relationship with China from Nixon to Clinton. That book was published in 1999. Of course, the book here, Rise of the Vulcans, is just out. It's out there in bookstores now if you want to read it. As we talk here this morning, questions are welcome, as always. We only ask that people who are listening try and be brief and make sure that there's plenty of room for other people and we keep the program moving along. Of course, anyone's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Mann, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Good to be with you, David.
We appreciate it. In the book, I hate to jump right to into the middle of the Iraq War.
Why not?
But that's probably as good a place as any to start. In the book that you write, that the decision to go into Iraq encapsulated virtually all the key elements in the Vulcans' views of the world and reflected the foreign policy ideas and themes the Vulcans had gradually developed over the previous three decades. So maybe we can start there with a thumbnail sketch of what are the key elements of the views of the world of these folks.
Sure. First of all, over three decades, this group of people has placed the highest emphasis on the importance of military power. Every one of the six of them worked at one time or another, usually for most of their careers, in the Pentagon. That's really the wellspring of their careers. Even the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, first work in Washington was for a year at the Pentagon. So that's the first thing, military power. Secondly, related to that, there's a reluctance to engage in, to reach accommodations with other countries. And I trace back to the 1970s when most of these people were opposed in one way or another to détente with the Soviet Union. The third common denominator among them really is a belief that America is a force for goodness around the world. I mean, many American leaders share that view, but not all. Certainly, in the 1970s, the Democrats in Congress did not believe that America was a force for goodness, and were imposing limits on American power. And then fourth, and this is really different from whether America is or is not a force for good around the world. Just apart from that, you have the question of how powerful is the United States? How much economic and military power does it have? This group of people has always tended to take a very expansive view. So, you know, in the late days of the Reagan administration, when a number of people across the spectrum said that the United States might be headed for a decline, that it was operating overseas with more power than it was going to be able to sustain, the Vulcans were the group of people who said, no, America actually has more capability than anybody believes. And that's really the shared view of this team.
I think it's interesting that you look at this group of people, and also you can look at, in previous administrations, similar kinds of groups of important advisors, and you look at their background, and that has a, maybe we shouldn't be surprised, has a very important influence on how they look at the world and how they think about policymaking. Right after World War II, we had a generation of advisors that came out of the business world, and that they had one view. The people who were around John Kennedy, the best and the brightest, as they have been called, those people came out of higher education and were academics. These people you're talking about here who make policy in the Bush administration, as you said, the very first point, they were all of them associated with the Pentagon and with the defense part of government. And in each of those cases, those groups of people very, very shaped by that, by the place that they came out of.
That's right. Yeah, the group of people after World War II, the people best known would be Dean Acheson, George Kennan, for example, but a whole other group of people. They were particularly interested in building new institutions. They were less interested in military power, though. Certainly, America had remarkable military power in the 40s, but. They're the people who created the whole series of institutions that held all through the Cold War and in many cases still today. This group of people is less interested in building institutions than, again, in exercising military power.
Mm-hmm. What's also striking is that you can see that the kind of views that these people hold, they were not always ascendant in the Republican Party. And if you go back to the Nixon administration, you can see that there was another pole here, and that was ideologically speaking, it was occupied by Henry Kissinger, and that some of these people butted heads with Dr. Kissinger because they had such fundamentally different ideas about the U.S. and what sort of role that it had to play in the world.
That's right. This group of people, some of them at least, were at odds with Henry Kissinger in two ways. The first, as you say, ideologically, during the particularly in the Ford administration in the early 70s, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz were all, in one way or another, opposed to Kissinger's policies towards the Soviet Union. So that's a question of views of the world and ideology. Secondly, I'd add as an aside, in retrospect, it's almost funny. But some of them were just plain bureaucratic adversaries of Henry Kissinger. So I describe in the first chapter of the book Don Rumsfeld, who's then he starts as a congressman from the Chicago area. But later becomes a domestic advisor running the anti-poverty program for Richard Nixon. And he really wants to get involved in foreign policy. He's interested in doing so. He doesn't have any leg. He doesn't have any particular issue to stand on. And he starts to oppose Henry Kissinger on the Vietnam War. And so you have this, what is now 30 years later, a supreme irony. Nixon and Kissinger nearly fired Rumsfeld for being within the Nixon administration an opponent of the Vietnam War. He was something of a dove.
Mm. All of these people had their formative experiences in government during the time of the Cold War. And I think that occasionally have been criticized for continuing to have a kind of a Cold War mindset in the post-Cold War era, at least up until September 11th. And a lot has been made of the fact that, for example, that I believe I have this right, on September 11th, Condoleezza Rice was going to give a speech about the Bush administration's security priorities, and what she was going to talk about was strategic missile defense. It didn't have anything to do with terrorism. It was about what had previously been called Star Wars. Do you think that it is true that somehow they still, and their approach to this particular challenge that now the United States faces, is still being shaped by their experiences of having been around during the Cold War when the big adversary was the Soviet Union?
Yes, I do. I mean, the another thing besides work in the Pentagon that they all share is that this is the group of people, this is a generation for whom the end of the Cold War, whether we want to date it from 89 in the fall of the Berlin Wall or the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, one way or another, that's just in the middle of their careers. So, you know, when we divide up history, naturally we think, you know, there's an abrupt break in history with the end of the Cold War and then a new era starts. Well, for them, it's really just, it's a middle chapter. And you can look on modern American foreign policy in a different way as running from the early 70s with America's defeat in and withdrawal from Vietnam to at least to 2003 and the war against Iraq as certainly for the careers of these Vulcans, an effort to rebuild American military power and make America the predominant power in the world.
Mm. We have a caller here and would certainly invite others into the conversation. Our guest is James Mann. He's a journalist who has written a lot about U.S. involvement in Asia. He was, for a period of time, a correspondent with the L.A. Times and covered Asia. He is author of a newly published book. It's entitled Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, which takes a look at some of the collective views and experiences of six individuals, and they are the people that we hear about all the time in the news, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice among them. If you're interested in reading the book, it's out now, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line number one.
Hi. Well, I first want to read something from the Dictionary of Studies of Classical Mythology about Vulcan, but then I'll have a question on torture lighter, torture for hire. But anyway, Pierre Grimald's book says, there was a tradition which attributes the construction of his first shrine, that's Vulcan's, to Romulus from the spoils of war taken from an enemy. During the Festival of Vulcan, little fish and often other animals were sometimes thrown into the fire. These offerings were supposed to represent human lives, and they were offered to Vulcan in order to preserve lives. So maybe you can talk about that, but I'll get to my next question about the relations to the Roman god that I just read and the underlings or little fish that are being punished for the psychological softening up or the torture light of, or, you know, mild torture of Iraqi detainees, and whether this reflects some systemic approach that may be going back decades, may not even be simply associated with the Vulcans, like Rummy. So how does these recent stories relate to what's going on in Guantanamo or the School of the Americas, which now has a new name, or Rummy's references to sending people over to Morocco or Syria or Saudi Arabia to be tortured and questioned?
Well, on your first question, I don't think really they gave themselves the name Vulcans in part. It's the Roman god of the forge, but more specifically, Birmingham, Alabama is a steel town. It's the town that Condoleezza Rice grew up in, and over it there's a huge statue of the Roman god of the forge. And I don't really think they chose this with knowing much of the mythology at all. I think it was sort of a joke, but it was meant to convey, I think, because they were quite public about calling themselves the Vulcans. It was meant to convey that these are tough guys. It was meant to convey toughness, durability, and so on. That's vaguely, distantly related to what you're saying, but torture, no, I don't think that's what they, I think that they can be criticized at most for sheer inattention and callousness on sort of looking the other way on abuses of prisoners, but as you know, actual planning years in advance on torture, no, I don't think so.
What about the structuring of the Pentagon and the apparent use of civilian contractors for interrogation? This is brought out in Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker that's on the Internet.
Right. I haven't read Hersh's article. His reporting on the war has been terrific. This is just out in the last couple of days, and I haven't yet read it. But certainly, they're contracting out anything and everything in order to, in some ways, not just to save money, but to evade responsibility.
Exactly. Yes, it seems that then there's no record keeping, or torture for hire employees may not be covered by the Geneva Conventions, or they may, as you said, just avoid being, they're off the radar.
The larger evasion of American responsibility is in, and this has been reported before, is turning over some of these people to the intelligence services of other countries that have fewer restrictions on how they treat prisoners. And so you have this process that's actually technically called rendition, where where a prisoner may be turned over to the Syrians, the Egyptians, some country whose intelligence service is working with the United States to conduct an interrogation.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest this morning is James Mann. He's currently a senior writer in residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Before that was, for a number of years, diplomatic correspondent and a foreign affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He covered China for the Times from 84 to 87. He was chief of the Beijing Bureau, and since then has covered all aspects of U.S.-China relations and also U.S. policy toward Asia. The book that we're talking about here this morning, his new book is Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, and Viking is the publisher. It's out there now. It seems that when you, at least on the surface, when you look at these people and what we know about conflict among them, and particularly the battles between the Pentagon and the State Department, it seems that the one guy here who looks like the odd man out is Colin Powell. And it may be that when you look more closely at him and his experiences, it seems that that's not the case. But at least on the surface, it looks that way.
Yeah, no, the conflicts between Colin Powell and the Defense Department, or more generally, some of the neoconservatives inside and outside the administration, are real. I mean, we've talked about some of the things that he shares in common with a general interest in military power, and he's over the years tended to support the Republicans on foreign policy. But the conflicts are real, and I trace them back. They really have their origins during the first Bush administration, when Dick Cheney is the defense secretary, Colin Powell is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the two of them are running the Pentagon together. Cheney's a civilian leader, Powell the uniformed leader. And on the surface, everything is fine. I mean, these are two guys who appear at press conferences all through the Gulf War together. They do victory parades together and so on. Beneath the surface, there's all kinds of tension, and the tension involves, from Cheney's perspective, civilian control of the military, from Powell's perspective, sort of the independence of the military, and they're fighting all the time. So in the early days after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, Colin Powell raises questions about whether the first Bush administration should respond. And Cheney's a little threatened by Powell, who's he's already been the national security advisor. He's got more power than any chairman of the Joint Chiefs ever has. And Cheney warns him, look, just keep in mind, you're not the national security advisor anymore. You're not the Secretary of State. Just stick to military matters. The broader questions are up to me. And this, you know, they have a whole series of disagreements in the early 90s. Actually, the day that Bush Sr. leaves office, Cheney also leaves without saying goodbye to Powell. And this serves as the backdrop for what happens at the end of the 2000 election, when Bush appoints Colin Powell as his first cabinet appointment to Secretary of State. And a whole Republican conservatives, veterans of the first Bush administration, start worrying that Powell is going to be the dominant force over all of American foreign policy. You know, it's hard to remember back then because Powell now seems so circumscribed. But what happened is that the original plan was to name a politician like Tom Ridge, who was then the governor of Pennsylvania, to be the defense secretary. And with inside the administration, inside the Republican Party, there was this groundswell of, watch out, Powell's going to have too much power. And at the last minute, Bush switched and appointed Don Rumsfeld to be defense secretary. Now, who was Don Rumsfeld? He was Cheney's closest ally for the longest period of time in American and Republican politics.
These people are in so many ways on the same page. You have to wonder that kind of bureaucratic infighting, whether that's about competing ideas or whether that's about competition for power and influence.
No, ideas are part of it, for sure. And Powell, I mean, they are competing for influence, but certainly Cheney is considerably more conservative than Powell, both on foreign policy and on domestic policy. And they each realize that they don't see eye to eye on a number of larger issues. They worked together in the first Bush administration, but again, there's a rivalry for influence, but also a disagreement on the way the world should work.
Let's talk with someone else here, caller. Someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. My question for the author, I'm not too sure that I understand it, but as I see it, this triumvirate has been together for 20 years or so, probably more than that. I've seen pictures of them at conventions many years ago. But some of the things that they seem to represent remind me awfully much of the goals of the Bilderberg Society. How close are they associated to the ideas of commanding the world's labor and controlling the world's capital?
Short answer, not very close. But let me ask, which triumvirate do you mean? I'm writing about...
Talking about Bush, Cheney, and the Secretary of State. I know that they're all three involved in the oil industry. In fact, I have a class action suit that's going before the Supreme Court right now that I'm involved in over asbestosis. And they're trying to get it thrown out of court, and all three of them are involved in it.
One of the early stages of my career, I covered the Supreme Court for many years. I doubt that the Secretary of State is paying much attention to a lawsuit at the Supreme Court, to be honest.
I wasn't referring to the Secretary of State particularly. I'm referring to the Department of Defense, the Vice President, and the President of the United States. Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush have been buddies for a number of years. And they're all in the petroleum industry, one way or the other, either supplying equipment and parts or one way or the other. And they have been. They're not newcomers to each other. In many ways, they remind me of the rise of of Adolf Hitler in the 20s.
Let me correct one thing. Actually, Rumsfeld and Cheney, the caller is correct. They've known each other for over 30 years. Cheney went to work for Rumsfeld in the Nixon administration. Neither one of them knew George Bush Jr. until the late 90s, really.
Well, that's not so.
And secondly,
they were together. They were seated together. They attended the Republican National Convention at the time of Richard Nixon.
George Bush Jr., he was about 20...
Right. They were all very young men. They've been together that long.
I'm sorry, I have to correct the caller.
Maybe you can go. I mean, the callers may, and, you know, maybe Mr. Mann, you want to go on and respond to some of the other kind of points the callers made.
Sure. On oil, and the caller is correct that Bush and Cheney have had ties to the oil industry. Rumsfeld far less so. He's spent most of his life and most of his business career with Searle, a pharmaceutical company. But I explain in the book that the general interest. Oil is important to this administration, less in the way that it's sometimes caricatured in the newspapers these days of, you know, wanting to get it's less a matter of profits for Halliburton, for example, than it is oil as geopolitics. I mean, if Iraq was on some other continent, I think their reaction would be different. But they've got a record going back to, you know, to the 70s, of interest in maintaining access to oil in the Middle East and making sure that no other country or power dominates control of oil. And actually, the most interesting person on that is another of the Vulcans that we haven't talked about, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who in the late 70s, he's working in the Pentagon and is asked to do a study of military force and how it might need to be used around the world. And he's supposed to look at the Persian Gulf, and he does what, you know, a zillion Pentagon officials would do and says, you know, what if the Soviet Union were to threaten the oil fields of the Persian Gulf? And then he does something that's new and different. He says, well, wait a minute, what if Iraq were to threaten the oil fields of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait? And it's really sort of the beginning of American concerns about Iraq, and it has to do with oil rather than necessarily abuses by Saddam Hussein, because they hadn't taken place yet.
Hmm. But it seems that you're making a very basic point about what it is these people think is important, and that for them... And it may indeed go back again to what we were talking about earlier, about the fact that all of them, one way or another, had some connection to or experience in the Pentagon. So it seemed that really security concerns, military defense security concerns, are the things that are uppermost in their mind, and they don't really think all that much about economic issues.
That is correct. That's my view. That's their main interest, security. You know, it's easy to parody someone like Cheney as coming from Halliburton, but, you know, I have just a completely different view of Cheney. Like many of the other Vulcans, he's interested in government and government power, and so he rarely, you know, he spent about barely 6 years out of the last 30 outside of public life, and as soon as his administration goes out of office in 1976, in the Ford administration, he's running for Congress within 6 months. When the first Bush administration goes out of office, he's running for president within weeks. I don't think he's as interested in private industry as he is in government, and I think that his views of oil have to do with its importance for military power.
We are already past our midpoint here. I have some other callers, and I need to move on. And I just want to, again, real quickly reintroduce our guest, James Mann. He's a senior writer in residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Before that, he was diplomatic correspondent and foreign affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He was, for a period of time between 84 and 87, the Beijing bureau chief for the LA Times, and has written a lot about relations between the U.S. and China, and generally speaking, U.S. policy toward Asia. His most recent book, it's just out, is titled Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. It's published by Viking. And again, the title, for anybody who has come in recently into the conversation, does not refer to the people from Star Trek, but it goes back to the fact that these group of people, even before President Bush the Younger was elected, they were assembled to advise on foreign policy, and they started referring to themselves as the Vulcans, taking the name of the Roman god of fire and the forge. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think we're getting a number of callers lined up, so again, people will help us by remembering that we're into our last 20 minutes now, and being brief will help us get everybody in. The next is in Champaign, and that's line number one. Hello.
Yes, I had a question for you regarding two other groups or a couple of individuals. One was Project for the New American Century. What is the relationship, say, between the Vulcans and those folks? As well as Karl Rove, if he has any working relationship with these guys. Is he in the group, so to speak, or out? I'll be quiet now and answer to or listen to the answer. Thank you.
Those are both real good questions. The I chose these six people because they were involved in American foreign policy in previous administrations, and part of the theme of the book is to see how the ideas evolved about the world from either Nixon, Ford, Reagan, first Bush administration to now, and to trace the continuities. Because of that, there are two people who are crucial for American foreign policy in some ways, who are not as much a subject of the book. One is the President of the United States, who took office without a record on foreign policy, and the second one is Karl Rove. The fact that he's not in the book does not mean he's irrelevant to American foreign policy. He's very influential. He does show up in the book in a way, in an incident, for example, that shows his influence. In 2002, there are large demonstrations in support of Israel on the Mall, and it's Rove who asks Paul or orders Paul Wolfowitz to go as the administration's representative. The second question, the Project for the New American Century. It's a leading neoconservative group, has some ties to members of this administration in the sense that in the late 90s they signed some petitions of the Project for New American Century. But the ties aren't quite that close. The Project for the New American Century actually supported John McCain for president in 2000. They've tended to be more hawkish than the administration. On Iraq policy,
We appear to have lost the guest. Not on our end, but perhaps something happened on his. We'll place the call again, and we'll get the guest right back, and I'm sure we'll resume our conversation with James Mann. Again, for anybody who's just tuned in, his new book is titled Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. This book is published by Viking. It's just out. I think we have the guest back, Mr. Mann?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, good. I think maybe we'll just go ahead and take our next caller in line, and that would be in Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. Friday, the Los Angeles Times, your old paper, I guess, somebody called Parag Khanna did an article called The U.S. Could Learn from EU's Old World Charm and Foreign Policy. And it dovetailed really well with with a call-in show on C-SPAN where Gunter Burkhardt, the ambassador of the European Union to the United States, spent an hour. And to talk about Khanna's article first, he points, I don't know if it's a he or she, points out that the EU now has 455 million people, population, an economy of 9 trillion, it has 1.5 million troops, and it does a better job of, promoting democracy than we do. And it does it primarily by exporting the EU legal code and by deploying, to quote the article, deploying massive economic subsidies and incentives. And in this way, it's fostered democratic consolidation all the way to Russia's border. And Gunter Burkhardt and his call-in Sunday morning was just amazing how he contrasted what Europe's doing to what the U.S. is doing in our hemisphere and the way it treats, you know, the poor countries. And I was just wondering if any of this is on the radar scope of these quote Vulcans unquote, if they have if they formulate any kind of concepts about what to do when the EU becomes as powerful a nation as we are. And I want to hang up and listen if you've got the question.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear. Thanks for the call. Mr. Mann,
points. First, as far as the EU and EU expansion, the Vulcans in general and the administration tend to be to say they're for it, but I have to add the huge qualification that at the crucial point in the debate leading up to the war with Iraq, the administration through Don Rumsfeld seemed as though it was trying to create divisions within Europe. People will remember Rumsfeld's remark about France and Germany being old Europe and countries like Poland being representatives of the new Europe. And secondly, I try in my book to trace through what I think was some of the mistaken logic. It was sincere but mistaken logic about allies that developed over the last 5 or 6 years from some of the Vulcans. And logic went like this. Our allies may say they're opposed to American policy, but really they're not. And once America leads, its allies in Europe will follow. This line of argument began in the late 1990s and continued all the way through till 2002, 2003. And I think they really believed it, and it turned out that they were incorrect.
Next is Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Sorry to keep you waiting. That was called the slipstream argument, if I recall. Once you launch the jets, the allies will follow in the slipstream.
Right.
If you remember that. Then it highlights the fact that the U.S. wants to use its comparative advantage, which is weaponry, as opposed to the soft power argument. But that's another book, another time. I wanted to point out that I think you're dismissing the New American Century group somewhat, because the nexus that I see is Pearl, the string of pearls, as it were. He was in the Reagan-Bush administration. He was called Prince of Darkness, if I recall. And he's sort of, I think, the linchpin that connects the two. And he's, for all his high publicity, he sort of gets distanced from by everybody, because he wrote the famous article in The Guardian about this is the death knell of the UN and good riddance kind of thing, which I think a lot of people in the Vulcan group are actually quite sympathetic to, but which makes it entirely humiliating for them to be in the position they are now. So if you want to respond to that, I have a couple other points. I don't know how many people are waiting.
Sure. On Pearl, you're right that he's close to the Project for New American Century. What I question, you used the word for publicity with Pearl, and I certainly agree. I actually think that Pearl gets more publicity than he actually has direct influence on this administration. I try to argue in the book, he's particularly close to Paul Wolfowitz and has been. They came to Washington together, as I describe, in 1969 as graduate students, and they've been quite close. But over the years, yes, Pearl worked in the Reagan administration, but he's tended to be sort of the outsider, and he's great at working with and establishing his influence on television and with media more than he is for the real nuts and bolts policy inside an administration. And I know he has a position that sounds like perhaps more than it is on the Defense Policy Board in this administration, or he was chairman of it. That it's actually something that meets about once a month or so in an advisory capacity. So a couple of people in the State Department used to call him the unpaid advisor, and that's kind of the role that he has. He's influential at lower levels of the bureaucracy, Undersecretary of Defense Doug Feist is quite close to him. But really, I think when they sit around the table and make decisions, that Pearl isn't there and isn't all that influential.
Well, I disagree. I think he's not in the nuts and bolts of it, but he's sort of the big picture guy, the leading edge. He makes everybody else look more moderate by being so extreme as far as being unpaid. He shakes down Adnan Khashoggi and has all these connections to the Boeing rental lease, long-term lease, since
Reed,
that, purchase
that's for
business.
That's for his own interest, and that's why he stays out of an administration. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, he's hardly unpaid. He's benefiting from the military-industrial complex. He's not in the nuts and bolts, but he's gathering what gets shaken out of the trees, and a lot is shaken out of the tree, and even this the current mercenary situation in Iraq is related to Cheney's work. When he was inside the government, he sort of made this. He wrote the privatization thing that allowed the Pentagon and other units of government to do this extreme privatization, where you don't have GIs rolling spuds anymore, and that's all done by Brown and Root, which in the Vietnam era was called burn and loot. I guess that was the joke for Brown and Root even in those days. But I do take the argument that it's not about oil individually, it's strategic. And we can also see that it goes over into the Democratic Party, and I don't know if you want to talk about that, but my linchpin for that is this guy Richard Morningstar, who is an advisor to Cheney, who during the Clinton administration, he was a number of roles, including one called the Caspian Basin Oil Diplomacy Initiative or something. So, I mean, it isn't just
Republicans.
Yeah, the oligarchy that we have in now. Though if you look at how many people in this administration are oil-involved, we have the salients like Condoleezza Rice. They've changed the name of the tanker, by the way. But if you go down even further, you find lots and lots of oil people all the way into the lower reaches. So it's sort of a state of mind as opposed to immediate profit. I would guess you would agree with that.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It's a good point on not being just Republicans. I do try to explain in the book, and I've tried to tell people from Europe, you know, don't assume that there's this night and day difference between the two parties. Suddenly what you think of as unilateralism is going to from the United States is going to stop with a Democratic administration. Because if you go back to the late 1990s, the Europeans had had plenty of objections to some of the Clinton administration's policies on the International Criminal Court, for example, or the Landmine Treaty. So there are a number of issues in which
the parties are alike. There are obviously some that they're not alike on.
We have a couple of other callers. I want to try to get them in. We have somebody in Iowa on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
I've got a question about the Iraq policy. There was a rationale on the run-up to the invasion that it would help settle the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and lead to the peace process. And I was wondering which of the Balkans has the president backing the Sharon Gaza withdrawal plan. Which Balkan is responsible for going in lockstep with Israel's policy? And I've got a second question with your Asian background. As this war on terror continues, we've got a lot of work ahead of us in South Asia. I wonder if you could maybe look farther down the road in this new war on terror. Thank you.
All right.
First, on the role of Israel and Iraq, I mean, the caller is absolutely correct that the theory that won out in this administration in 2002 and early 2003 was this, that an American victory in Iraq would isolate the Palestinian leadership. At the time, they were thinking of Arafat in the same way as the end of the first Gulf War left Arafat isolated, and that in some way, in a victory in Iraq, would contribute to bringing towards a peace settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. And that has not so far certainly turned out to be correct. There was a rival theory, which was pushed by some of the moderates within the administration, which is, you know, before we deal with Iraq, we've got to make some headway on peace between Israel and the Palestinians. So it was that Iraq should come second. Obviously, that theory lost. On South Asia, I can't say enough about the importance of Pakistan and the future of Pakistan. It seems to me that that's really a priority and problem number one, and maybe one, two, and three in dealing with terrorism and South Asia and the region in general. First of all, because of its position in the region, and second of all, because of its nuclear weapons program.
Mm-hmm. Let's go on to Urbana, line number one for someone else right here. Hello.
Yes. I've noticed that if anybody criticizes the neocons, they're likely to get attacked for being anti-Semitic, and because I suppose there are so many Jewish members of that group, and I was wondering, is this just a coincidence, or is there any particular reason that Jews would feel attracted to these aggressive Bush policies? I'll hang up and listen now.
All right. Well, Mr. Mann, can you comment on that?
Not sure. I mean, really, the neoconservative movement has roots. Whatever connections there would be, and I'm not sure there are any, go way back to the 30s and 40s, because the neoconservative movement grew out of the Democratic Party and Democratic liberalism. But as far as the role of religion, I mean, I think I'll leave that.
Well, religion aside, is it not the case that the people that we're talking about always have had a very strong commitment for the state of Israel?
Yes. Yeah.
We're almost to the point where we're going to have to finish, and I feel that we have not done a very good job of describing what is a very far-reaching book. And as you've made several times, is that we're talking about people whose careers and whose ways of thinking span now three decades. and have been involved in many Republican administrations and within Republican circles, going back all the way back to Richard Nixon, far back before, indeed, the current President Bush. If let us suppose that the president is not reelected and there's a Democratic president, what happens to these people, and does their influence continue? And if then the next president was a Republican, would we see them as important advisors in some capacity, whether official or otherwise? Again, you think?
I think it's different for different people. The younger ones, I think Condoleezza Rice probably is a candidate to appear in some future administration. Again, that would depend on the extent to which people remember how people view the events of this administration. If it's 4, 8, or 12 years from now viewed as an incredible disaster, then Rice would be associated with it. Certainly, I don't think Rumsfeld will be part of some future administration. The larger question of the would be the influence of
the ideas.
Yeah, the ideas and the neoconservatives among the Balkans. And I would say that when you say if Bush were to lose, I would assume that he would lose because people are less than happy with the venture in Iraq. It could be the economy, but certainly Iraq would be part of it. And so you have to wonder how many of the ideas will survive, or whether their influence will wane. And I tend to look on this era, sort of early 70s to the war in Iraq, as a distinct era that may, I think the preoccupation with military power will begin to diminish. I think the expansive view of America as, of an America that can do whatever it wants in the world, and that is not limited by its resources and budgets and available troops and so on, I think that will diminish. So, again, I think that, the influence probably peaked in 2003 at the time of the Iraq War.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our guest, James Mann, senior writer in residence at Center for Strategic and International Studies, former diplomatic correspondent and foreign affairs columnist for the LA Times. The book is Rise of the Balkans, A History of the Bush's War Cabinet, published by Viking.